this fifth of the clear mind precepts. And yeah, I also was just thinking about how the precepts, how we work with the precepts is there's no blueprint. It's not black and white. And it seems to me that, at the base, compassion is the most important thing. Some combination of wisdom and compassion and figuring that out is up to us. There's, that's our path to choose. So I wanted to begin by stating the Bodhidharma's version of this fifth precept and get started with that. Bodhidharma's version goes like this: Self nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the intrinsically pure Dharma, not arousing ignorance is called not being intoxicated. So let's look first at the word ignorance. It's one of, as in not arousing ignorance. Ignorance is one of the three poisons, the three, along with greed and aversion or hatred, the source of all unwholesome karma or all unwholesome things comes from greed, hate, and delusion or ignorance. The word literally means in English not knowing or turning away from. And here we mean turning away from the basic reality of interconnection and transience. For me, though, he talks about arousing, not arousing ignorance, but I'm usually not aware of arousing ignorance. It just seems to rise up on its own in my life. But when I notice it, when I happen to notice it, my practice is just to try to see it and let it go. One of the next things that occurs to me about in thinking about this precept is its basic similarity to the thrust of all the other precepts we were just talking about. Our life, as Bodhidharma says, is wondrous and inconceivable, and yet we're often in the habit of turning away, separating ourselves from other people and from the wonder of it. We kill rather than nurture. We lie rather than live in truth. We hoard things rather than share the bounty that's not our own. Our karmic existences bring us to this point. And the great thing about Zen practice is that it's this very karmic existence that's nothing other than the ground of our practice. As we recently studied with Norman in seminar, we avow our ancient twisted karma before taking the precepts. We acknowledge and meet ourselves as we are, with all of our fears, our desires, and our dissatisfactions. And the radical thing about Zen practice is that when we meet our habitual thought and behavioral patterns, we meet them and apply the vow to save all beings. What's the best way to act in that situation that will save or help beings? Dogen in Fukan Zazengi says, "Here is the place, here the way unfolds." And in Genjo Koan says, "When you find yourself where you are, right where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point." Bodhidharma teaches self nature is inconceivably wondrous, yet again and again I find myself either turning away from self nature in each moment or blinded to self nature, or I think otherwise we could call big mind or Buddha mind. I'm often not satisfied with self nature in each moment, and rather than turn toward it, I shield myself from it. I might like to do something to perk up the moment, make it more interesting somehow, or make the moment maybe last longer, or maybe make it try to go away a little faster. Whatever the exact nature of our dissatisfaction, we often find ourselves turning away from the moment. We may stop putting our whole being into what we're doing or dealing with, and we may distract ourselves with addictive drugs, alcohol, or behaviors that can become addictive, things like internet shopping or gambling or games or the endless round of YouTube, Facebook, and email chasing. We may also distract ourselves with emotional stories that we tell ourselves and others. As Norman says, in Taking Our Places, an intoxicant can be anything that functions in our life to blunt the force of our awareness, preventing us from experiencing our life as it really is in all of its aspects. And oftentimes, Norman points out, we have strong unconscious psychological pain that we may try to mask with substances or behaviors that can become sometimes uncontrollable in themselves, and for which we may eventually need help from sangha, therapists, or groups of like-minded people suffering under the same burdens, either before or sometimes after such addictive behaviors become debilitating. When I examine this precept, I have to ask myself to notice each day how and when I may be turning away from my life experience. I try to notice those moments when I forget the teaching to settle the small self on the deep ground of big self, big mind, Buddha mind. At 5 o'clock on some afternoon, when I would like to drink a beer as I begin to prepare dinner, is it just because I'm thirsty and I'd like the refreshment? Or is there some feeling of dissatisfaction or pain in my present state of mind that I'm trying to, quote, improve, or that I don't want to face, may not want to face? Perhaps I'm looking to numb out a feeling of discomfort, some feeling of insufficiency with myself or the particular situation. What happens if I delay having that beer? Can I delay having that beer? Can I drink with the full recognition of what I'm doing without fooling myself in some way? Am I drinking the beer, or is the beer drinking me? It may seem like a lot to ask of a simple impulse to drink a glass of beer, but our practice, I think, is really found in looking as intimately as we can at ourselves in such moments. I was once invited to a dinner right after one of Shohaku Okamura's Genzo-e sessions, and I happened to be seated right next to him. As the waitress in the restaurant came around taking orders for drinks, I was highly conflicted. Do I order a drink in front of Okamura Roshi and right after a session, no less? The waitress, luckily for me, took his order first, and he promptly ordered a glass of red wine. Now feeling more comfortable, I followed suit. And quickly, rather quickly, it seemed she came around again. And to my surprise, he ordered a second glass. I doubted that he was as mixed up about the wine in the sort of way that I was, in the same sort of way that I was. Not very long ago, I had a major upheaval with my sister and my father. Nowadays, if I find myself walking along in my by now very familiar neighborhood, perhaps a little bit bored, and thoughts of my sister and my anger with her for her role in our recent family drama come up, do I seize the thoughts and emotions, pushing them along, in some ways maybe enjoying the familiar feelings of anger, hurt, and self-righteous indignation. I think this is a very useful arena of practice, those karmic entanglements that seem not to let go of us. Excuse me. That seem not to let go of us, nor we of them. How much time have I spent telling the stories of the various indignities that I feel have been done to me, telling them to others and to myself? This can be an insidious form of intoxication, I think. I think it may also be a very fruitful one from a practice perspective to address, to look at. For usually, of course, here in this arena, there are feelings that are deeply rooted in our personal stories, our personal histories, our sense of who we think we are. I think that this may be why these stories can be so addictive, that they are so familiar and so comfortable to us, our comfortable, habitual way of being in the world. Of course, I don't mean to say that thinking and talking about the events of our lives and our relationships may not be a completely natural and a very useful thing to do sometimes. I do think it's important, though, to look at when this kind of thinking might slip into indulgence of anger or some other powerful emotion, a form of intoxication. In her book, Opening to Oneness, the teacher Nancy Mujo Baker lists various mental habits and psychological patterns that we often get into and which cloud our perception of our universe, which may keep us from attending to what's before us. I'm sure we're all pretty familiar with these habits of mind. Here's a list, a few from Nancy Baker's list. Daydreaming, a form of tuning out. Stories of blaming of others, analyzing or overanalyzing, justifying oneself, infatuations, being a victim, being confused. My personal favorite these days is trying to determine whether I think I'm measuring up to some impossible standard to be better than I think I am right now, which often devolves into an endless loop of self-evaluation in which I continually fall short, and which often involves significant anxiety and depression. Yet, despite the negative feeling of this particular thought pattern, I seem to return to it again and again. As Nancy Mujo Baker points out, there seems to be something there for me, some kind of comfort that keeps me coming back for more. Occasionally, though, when I'm exhausted with it all, it may fall away, leaving only the stark reality of this tender, vulnerable life. This precept asks us to resist clouding the mind and to cultivate clarity. What will we do with our one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver asks? If we truly appreciate the preciousness and the wildness, the inconceivability and the absolute value of each moment, how will we face the impulse that may arise to alter it, to modify it, to try to add something to it, or to take something away? Reb Anderson, in his book on the precepts, encourages us to trust being upright instead of using intoxicants as the best way to deal with our restlessness, our anxiety, and our pain. He says that without any tampering or manipulation of what is happening, the way of freedom from suffering, the way of freedom from suffering unfolds here. He says, the precepts are all one thing. They are Buddha's mind. They show the ways that we get distracted from Buddha's mind. Each way of distraction from Buddha's mind is also a way of reunion with Buddha's mind. The precepts show how we lean away from our Buddha nature, and they are the road back. So I'll stop with that and thank you very much. Appreciate your attention. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. We'll have a minute of just silent meditation, of silence, and I'll ring the bell after a minute. Thank you, Michael. I'm going to, I guess, spotlight myself, if I can find it. Okay. And I'm going to do my best to talk here about this precept without having a coughing fit. My mind's been a little clouded just by illness this last about week and a half. I've got Now what I have is a sinus infection, and I'm doing my best. I may start coughing. I have a cough drop, so bear with me if I do, but hopefully it'll all be good. Well, that was such a wonderful talk, and I'm probably going to have to refer to some of pieces of it a little bit, Michael. That was lovely. I wanted to read four different versions of this precept, just so we hear it, hear the slight nuances and the commonalities. The ones I've chosen, this one is the one that was part of the version we read. We chanted the whole thing to start. A disciple of the Buddha does not intoxicate self or others with substances or doctrines. A disciple of the Buddha promotes clarity and awareness. So that's probably an everyday Zen version. The next one, proceed clearly. Do not cloud the mind, White Plum Sangha. And I think, Michael, you really spoke to the ways that we can cloud our minds on many levels. Thank you, thank you. The next, cultivating a mind that sees clearly. This is the practice of not being deluded. I will embrace all experiences directly without the many intoxicants of this world. And that's Upaya Zen Center. And then the last one I want to read, cultivating a mind that sees clearly. This is the precept of not being ignorant. I'm going to be, well, I will be speaking of things that get in the way, but also of then ways to cultivate a clear mind. The focus really in this precept is on cultivating and maintaining a clear mind. And cultivation, you know, it's like a gardening. You dig in the dirt, You have to weed some things out, like some of our habits and more comfortable ways to do things, but maybe they're not helpful. Maybe they cloud our mind. Maybe patterns of thought, as Michael spoke. When you garden, you have to also, when you're cultivating the soil, you have to put nutrients in. So it's your companions, it's the things you read, who what you listen to, what you read in the newspaper. Also, you have to nurture and tend new little shoots. Maybe you're trying something new, trying some new pattern. You have to nurture and tend it with utter kindness. I want to say it now, Michael, you spoke very well about intoxicating self or others with substance. I want to just say a little more about that. Substance use can be tricky. It can sneak up on you. I experienced that in my life with my mother after menopause. She, was an upright, upstanding minister's wife, and but she was having a lot of difficulties way back then. There was no help or conversation, and so she and my dad would just settle down with a drink at night, or two, or three. And for my mom, unfortunately, her physiology was such that it became a more alcoholic pattern. But nobody outside of our family would know it. But it snuck up on her. And it was something difficult to deal with really till the end of her life, though she and my dad really worked at it. And I'm proud of them for that. But it snuck up. It's easy to push the boundary. And I guess that's because with all of our addictions of various sorts, denial plays a big part in it. We just don't see what's happening as we get deeper into it, and then we get kind of lost. So, as Michael began to suggest, what to do? Seek help. I just want to really emphasize, if you have an inkling that that's something going on with you, talk to your teacher, whoever your Norman or whoever your teacher is. Or a therapist, or a Dharma brother or sister to start, or maybe go to try out an AA meeting or NA meeting. But if you just have that inkling, seek help because it isn't a shame. We so much operate out of shame, but it isn't shameful. It's just somehow life's difficulties have taken you down a path that, oh, that solution isn't working. But it's not shameful. You just want to get help to work with it. And this precept is pushing us that way because it wants us to be clear, to be open, to be alive. Well, Michael, you kind of helped me shorten up some of my talk because you really spoke so well of the things, other things aside from drinking that cloud our mind. I was thinking of the phone, and I just like to scroll sometimes and see and click on something and see if something will pop up. That is addictive. It actually releases some chemicals in our brain that give us a little, that felt good. So I've had to practice setting my phone aside because it's kind of, I can feel it turning my brain to a little bit of jello. Lately, in our current political environment, I find myself a little bit addictively checking for bad news, and I get ramped up. I can feel my body, my adrenaline, everything getting going. And it's not grounded and not helpful. I'm checking the headlines, the Washington Post, the Times, to see if what great horrors happen next, or is my wife, who's a probationary worker, going to get for the federal government, going to get laid off tomorrow? Which she could. We don't know. So I am really experiencing this in your body, in my body. So what I want to say is stay attuned to your body. Notice how things feel. I'm trying now to really, okay, I've looked at these headlines already 15 times today. Do I need to do it again? this is really clouding my spirit and heart. One thing, I think a couple other things, I just think of living here in community, in a co-housing community, how easy it is to begin gossiping. We want to say things about the other people in the community, but we don't want to say them to them. That's how it relates to that previous precept, right? And I find myself having to work on that. And how do I deal with my irritation? If I'm irritated with somebody, well, maybe gossiping lets off steam, but it doesn't really help. And it's a form of othering, making the person other. And somehow that's where ignorance comes in. Because, Michael, you said it so beautifully. I wrote it down. You said ignorance is one of the three poisons, turning away from the basic reality of interconnectedness and transience. Because when we are othering people, we turn away from our interconnection with them, and really the impermanence of life. This life is short. It's everything changes. Let's try to stay present. So I've been really working with as one way to help myself with that is working with the sense of no separate self. All the people in my community, even the ones I have difficulty with, we're not separate. We're interconnected. So how does that inform how I think about them, how I practice with the difficult emotions that may arise in me? And certainly in our political situation, how do I do that? So now I'm going to focus on pretty much on ways to kind of maintain, how to maintain and cultivate a clear mind. But I usually do best when I have some images to work with. So I'm going to share with you a couple images, and I feel a little sheepish about this, but they come from a classroom guidance program I used to teach when I was an elementary school counselor. And I used to teach, you know, first, second graders about problem solving and, you know, getting along with others, resolving their little conflicts or dealing with things. And the program the kids really liked when I taught it was called Pumsy. And, you know, Pumsy, I had a little dragon puppet I used to, and that's Pumsy. Pumsy's a little dragon. And there was a storybook, and so I'd read it and share it. And, of course, Pumsy had a lot of problems with her thinking, and she had trouble. But she had a schoolyard friend who kind of helped her. And her friend taught her about that she had a mud mind mood and a clear mind mood. And so I would do a little demonstration for the kids. And I'm going to describe the demonstration because this is the image that really helps me to sense, oh yeah, I'm in a mud mind now. Oh yeah. So, or clear mind. So here's, you have to envision I'm holding a jar of clear water. Beautiful. And I'd show it to the kids and we'd say, ah, you can see, well, this is like how when you're feeling good and solid and grounded, this is your clear mind. This is how your mind feels. But then I also had a bottle of black ink, and I said to the kids, yeah, but maybe something happens. Maybe at lunch you spilled your lunch all over everything, and I'd squirt some ink into the jar. Or maybe your parents had a fight last night, squirt. Or your best friend didn't come to school, squirt. Or you didn't understand what the teacher was saying and you got yelled at, squirt. Or whatever, there were millions of them, and the kids certainly told me more. And we'd look at it and we'd say, wow, it's all cloudy. It's cloudy. Do you think you can think clearly? Oh, not very much. And so the kids could begin to notice when they were in a mood where they felt like, wow, I am not thinking clearly. This is my mud mind. But they didn't have to say they were bad. It's just, wow, I'm cloudy now. Then the next example was about what a clear mind might be like. And so I'd show them another clear jar of water. But what I was going to squirt in it was a mixture of motor oil and and black oil paint. So the same thing, this happened, that happened, squirt, squirt, squirt. But, you know, with that, the black stuff stayed on top. And then the water was still clear. So I would tell the kids, well, this is how it is when you can get your mind, you can get quiet and get your mind clear. You still know that something happened. Things happen that have to be dealt with, that you could ask for help or something, but your mind is still there. So maybe you're not going to go out and punch somebody or call somebody else a name or whatever. And then we would talk about how do you get from this mud mind mood to the clear mind mood where you can think more, better. So I was thinking about that for us as adults. How do we get from these times when we feel like our mind is clouded and muddy to more in a clear mind? It's not like things weren't happening, but we have a grounded sense. And I'd say the first thing, it's the beginning, the middle, and the end, is Zazen. Practice Zazen. Practice Zazen every day. Just do it. So you get in your body that sense, which many of you do, of sitting, grounded, your breath coming and going, connected to a larger big mind, Buddha mind. You're just right there every day. And then it'll be a tool for you at other times when maybe stuff's coming up and you don't know what's going on. You can come back to your cushion and it will help. And I'll say more about that in a moment. Spiritual friendships are also a way to cultivate a clear mind. Buddha emphasized spiritual friendships as very important, the whole of the way. These are relationships, our Dharma brothers and sisters here, where we can be honest with one another from the depths of our hearts, and we don't have to feel ashamed of our shortcomings. And then, let me see. Another thing is what I'd mentioned before, remembering that no separate self. When I have a tendency to solidify, oh yeah, we're not separate, be curious. So for me, a phrase is be curious. But sometimes all this can be hard and we need some more techniques. Excuse me. So I have a few techniques that I want to share with you before I end my talks, and this will take a little bit. One is a sort of another image that is very helpful to me in working with my mind and working in in maintaining a clear mind, and it comes from Harry Potter stories. I don't know if you've read them or not. I probably have read them hundreds of times, but in the Harry Potter stories, Professor Dumbledore, you know, the wizard, he has a thing called a pensieve. It's a wonderful play on words, right? A pensieve. And so he was telling Harry Potter that when he has a lot of troubling thoughts, his mind is clouded, he's in a mud mind mood, he takes his wand and he extracts thought by thought and drops them into the pensieve and clears out his mind. And so I'm thinking, I do that in imagination. That one into the pensieve. And then Dumbledore would go back to the pensieve when he could, and he would take one out to experience and contemplate and sort out how do I handle this? So using that as a guide, I have a way of doing that where when there's something disturbing me, whether it's thoughts, feelings, a situation with people here, my feelings about what's going on in the world, I will first sit in Zazen. And then I will just settle, feel my breath, my body. And when I have a sense of groundedness, I will on purpose bring forward the thought or the feeling, the situation, into my mind. But I will offer it to the Buddha. I offer it and let it just, you know, then I keep breathing with it. I don't try to think it out, like think what to do, but I hold it present in contemplation in the arms of Buddha and breathe with it. And often what happens is some other thoughts, some other ideas, new ways of seeing the situation do arise. And I find a way through that I never could have just think through. I never could have. And by the way, in Pumsi, that's called your sparkler mind, where you get settled and you contemplate, and then you get ideas arise that are helpful. You may not want to do that kind of thing in your meditation period. You may want to take that thought out of your pensive and put it to your journal. You may want to light a candle and then say, I'm going to write about this thought, maybe write the thought or feeling or situation at the top of the journal and or page. I'm going to write for 5 minutes without stop. Don't lift the pen. And just see what comes. You'll find other things underneath. And that and you can continue to do that 1 minute, 5 minutes, 20 minutes. When you're done, bow and extinguish the candle, because you create sacred space to do it. Similarly, if you don't want to write, perhaps you want to paint or draw or color. That's been an avenue that in the past has really helped me, because actually, I'm a terrible artist. I can't make anything look like anything. So I've stopped worrying about it, and I just enjoy the colors and the movement. And so if I have sort of a situation or a feeling, I just let I think about it, and then I let the colors choose me, and I do them on the paper or the movement of my arm. I let it come quickly. And then I do another one, and I'll do a series. And I find that through the series, what was troubling me can be clarified. And I can get a better ground of how to work with it. Some people use expressive movement. I'm not one of those, but you might be. And then two other practices, and these I've been doing pretty much regularly, since January 20th, and really since the election, but I've stepped it up. But before that, it's metta and tonglen. I feel a great deal of disturbance inside and wind myself up in not healthy ways, worrying about our world, what elected officials are doing, worrying about the poor people who are living in fear all over the globe. And so I start with myself, and I offer metta, well-being. And then I extend it out to people for whom I'm concerned. And then I have to be settled to do this, but then I will include our elected officials by name, which can sometimes be difficult because I don't want to say their name. But I'll include them by name and visualize them and wish them, may you be happy. May you be deeply happy. May you be well. May you be filled with loving kindness and dwell in the heart. May you be free from suffering and fear. May you be at peace and at ease. And so I offer that, and then I come back to myself. I do a similar process with Tonglen, though that's a little more involved, and I see my time's up, so I won't go into that right now. But metta is what I do a lot, because sometimes I don't know what else to do, but I can send well-being out, even to the people whom I have trouble caring for at all. But yet we're all interconnected, and it's important. So the last thing I want to leave you with is come back to Zazen, to your ground. And then I want to share a verse Chris shared with me once years ago. I think I've shared this before in other talks, but it helps me so much, and it's a way I practice to maintain a clear mind. I was going to Chris for Dokusan, and I was quite upset about a number of things and wound up And it, my imagery for it was being very slow or being very wild. So she wrote a verse for me, and she said, her verse was, "We're sitting together, grounded in presence, grounded in present, with love, with slowness and wildness, falling over and over into Buddha's deep lap of love." And so when I'm really in a state, I can repeat that to myself, and it helps me calm. Maybe you have some other sort of mantra or saying, something you can bring to say to yourself that helps you come back home, calm down, and to work with your mind. So I think that's more than enough from me. Thank you. Now comes a minute of silence. Again, I'll ring the bell when that minute is up. So now, this is really the hard part. I have to put you into breakout groups. And I think, Michael, I wrote down the questions. We wanted to ask you to take into the breakout groups. How do you cultivate or maintain a clear mind? Or what do you notice about behaviors or habits of mind that stand in the way of cultivation of a clear mind? Or anything else that came up to you in the course of the talks. I think we'll have 15 minutes.